We're checking out the box office, the high-grossing blockbusters, the smaller gems that shouldn't go unnoticed. It's Movies with you here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the year is winding down, summer blockbuster season way behind us, but there are still quite a few movies coming to a theater near you. Let's name some names here. Joker, Frozen 2, Star Wars, The Rise of Skywalker. How do you feel about sequels and remakes? What about franchises? Are you all in? We're at 800-642-1234. Chris Yogerst is an assistant professor of communication in the Department of Arts and Humanities at UW-Milwaukee. Chris, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you for having me back.
And Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here. She's a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater, teaches courses on film. Anna, welcome back to you.
Thank you. Happy to be here again. Yep.
So before we get to the movies coming out this fall, let's talk about some recent ones. And, you know, here's a warning. We might touch on a few spoilers here and there, but try not to. Both of you, though, were fascinated to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood from director Quentin Tarantino.
All right, what's the matter, partner?
It's official, old buddy. Well, it has been.
So that is Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio very quickly in that trailer. Anna, why did this movie speak to you and get your attention?
Well, I am a Tarantino fan, and I think that's part of it. His reputation certainly precedes him. And, you know, this is a film, too, that was really... you know, it's so much about kind of the nostalgia for old Hollywood, for the old ways of Hollywood and kind of the old times of big movie stars as well. And so it's a movie that, you know, is of Tarantino's style, but it's also a movie that is rather sweet. It's a sort of a sun-drenched, melancholy film. And it's also a rumination, I feel, too, on stardom as well. Mm. I mean, it stars Leonardo DiCaprio as a sort of a fading movie star, someone who'd had a career mostly in television in the 50s. And then by the late 1960s, 1969, to be exact, is kind of, you know, as you heard there in the clip, a bit of a has-been, and he's trying to sort of reinvigorate his career. And, and you know, it's a, you know, that is a kind of a theme that many films in Hollywood have visited before. And Tarantino kind of takes his own sort of unique take on this particular theme, all against the backdrop of, you know, this kind of the film, you know, also dramatizes the relationship of Roman Polanski and Sharon Tate. And, you know, that in obviously in reality, that had a very terrible end. And so Tarantino sort of takes that story and, you know, gives it his own unique sort of fantastical spin. And, and it's just a really interesting film.
Well, Chris Yogerst, you know, I'm wondering if this is a love letter to filmmaking for you, because Tarantino, he's like got that disconnected, that non-linear filmmaking style that goes kind of brings, you know, lots of disconnect, discord. Does that work this time?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, it's funny you mentioned the non-linear narrative that he's so drawn to. I almost feel like this is his most linear film, actually. So, like, it's easiest to follow. I guess maybe the last couple, Hateful Eight, was pretty linear as well, in compared to the rest of his films. But I agree. I think it works. I think the movie is it's a little bit of historical wish fulfillment, which he's dabbled in. But I also agree. I mean, I agree with Anna. I mean, he's depicting a time period. This was a period that was both beautiful and tragic. In a lot of ways, it was a period of the changing of the guard for Hollywood. The old studio system was just about gone. New stars were rising, new power structures were rising, and this is what Leonardo DiCaprio finds himself in the middle of and struggling. And Tarantino is undoubtedly familiar with this history, and then he very creatively works it into the Manson issue. But it's also just a beautiful
Manson murders.
The Manson murders. Beautiful depiction of Los Angeles, and anyone who's been to Los Angeles knows it's very much a combination of very beautiful things and some very not so beautiful things.
We are discussing movies this hour with two Wisconsin film educators, Chris Yogerst and Anna Thompson-Hodgick. You can join the conversation any point here, 800-642-1234. Which new movies have you seen and loved this year? Which ones were letdowns? What are you excited to see this fall as we head into the Thanksgiving season? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Chris, we got another look this month at Batman's nemesis, the Joker, and this time with Joaquin Phoenix playing the supervillain.
My mother always tells me to smile and put on a happy face.
Okay, so pretty gruesome, though, as we look at the origins of the Batman villain. So what is the controversy surrounding this film?
It's been interesting. I mean, the way I would describe the movie, and I can do this with a promise, everybody, I can avoid spoilers. It's basically an adaptation of this character from the perspective of what it would look like if this happened in real life. And I think this is what made some people nervous, that this movie might spark imitation, and this movie might inspire, you know, people on the edge to do some terrible things. But what interested me is that all of this came about before anybody had seen the movie. And I find that anybody who does see the movie or anyone who has seen the movie will find the movie not this this massively violent juggernaut that it was feared to be. I mean, it's undoubtedly violent, it's rated R, but it's very much a treatise on mental health, and it provokes conversation about that. And that's what producer Michael Uslan and director Todd Phillips were hoping that this was going to do. And they've said that in interviews. But I find the controversy to kind of have fizzled out. There's a lot of fear that there's going to be violence in the theaters, and none of that happened. So the whole thing became not only a commentary, the film itself, on mental health, but the controversy and how it was covered gives us a lot to think about with how the media works as well today.
Well, Anna, this controversy about Joker isn't really new, whether movies can risk inspiring violence by glorifying it. Are there some past examples or research to justify that concern?
Well, you know, that sort of media narrative is always rather overblown, you know, and there's we can look at back at moments in popular culture where, you know, the media or a media product gets blamed for, you know, in the 1950s, comic books were blamed for the spike in juvenile delinquency, you know, and in the 1980s and even, you know, in the last year, video games seem to be sort of perennial scapegoats as well. I think there was some headlines generated a few weeks ago. The movie theater in Aurora, Colorado, where the shooting took place, where the shooter was inspired by the Dark Knight Rises. That theater came out publicly and stated they are not going to show the film, and it was kind of a big to do because the theater owner wrote the producers at Warner Brothers to state openly, we're not going to show this film. We're not going to glorify, you know, the violence depicted in Joker. But again, it's films are unfortunately made to be scapegoats for this sorts of, you know, these sorts of issues, and that is unfortunate. And just as Chris said, that kind of blame is misguided, certainly.
Talking with Anna Thompson-Hodgick and Chris Yogerst, our guides, what do you think about the portrayals of women in Hollywood? Do you think the film industry is moving in the right direction? Do you follow the film industry? What do you think has changed? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we talk movies here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. The fall movie schedule features a mix of acclaimed films likely to pick up Oscar buzz. There are horror films that will cater to the Halloween crowd. And then there are movies that simply couldn't fit into the summer season. We're touching on a lot of them with you. Tell us your favorite film of all time. What would you like to see more of from Hollywood? Were there any films you were pleasantly surprised by this year? What do you think about the portrayals of women in Hollywood? Join in at 800-642-1234. Chris Yogerst and Anna Thompson-Hodgick teach film courses at UW-Milwaukee and UW-Whitewater, respectively, and they stay with us through the hour. So let's talk about women in movies. It's been 2 years since the Me Too movement took off in the wake of allegations against Harvey Weinstein. Anna, have you seen a notable shift in the film industry since the Me Too movement?
No, I think so. There certainly are movies that and directors, female directed films, that are getting more buzz. Certainly I think someone that has really seen her star rise as a performer and a director is Greta Gerwig. And, she got a lot of attention last year with her film Lady Bird that she directed. She has a movie coming out on Christmas Day, actually, appropriately, a new version of Little Women quite a really progressive pedigree. Saoirse Ronan, who also starred in Lady Bird, is playing Jo March. And again, this is a movie that, another perennial favorite of a film that in 1994 also had a female cast that was with Winona Ryder and Susan Sarandon, along a movie that's kind of attracted strong women. But the fact that Gerwig is also we have a female director attached to this, I think is really interesting. And then you have movies too that there's a movie coming out in November, a long in the works film, Harriet, the biopic of Harriet Tubman, and that too has a female director, Cassie Lemons, who directed Eve's Bayou back in the 90s as well, and that again she is both a female director and African American director, and again these I think studios are really putting resources behind these films as well to really promote them, and in a post-Weinstein Hollywood, that is significant, where you really are seeing these movies both promoted, resources behind them. So yes, I think there are more opportunities for women both in front and behind the camera.
Well, Chris, on November 1st, we get that another biopic about one of our nation's anti-slavery heroes.
You have made it 100 miles to freedom all by yourself. Would you like to pick a new name to mark your freedom?
Harriet Tubman. If I'm free, my family should be too. I made up my mind. I'm going back.
So we have Cynthia Erivo, who plays the Underground Railroad icon Harriet Tubman. Chris, what are you hearing out of that film?
That one, I actually haven't seen the trailer of that yet. So this is, I've seen some of the headlines about it, and it looks really. I haven't seen the trailer. It sounds very interesting, and I agree with Anna that there's. We're seeing more and more of this. I'm starting, as the film historian, I'm starting to see more and more movies, or at least a trend that feels much more like the 1930s Hollywood, where there were probably more female-centered movies and more progressive roles for women than any point in Hollywood. And I also have to say, I share the appreciation for Greta Gerwig. She's been an amazing actress, and now she's starting to helm more movies, and it's absolutely wonderful. And I'm also reminded of she's more in the indie scene and breaking more into the mainstream, which is wonderful. But I'm also thinking of like somebody like Patty Jenkins, who directed Wonder Woman, which I thought was a great addition to the superhero pantheon. But she also did helmed a show that aired last fall, I believe, called Into the Night, about Fauna Hodel, who is the daughter of George Hodel, who was allegedly tied up into, even though they haven't solved it, the Black Dahlia murders in the 1940s. So she's getting some pretty high profile projects that I've enjoyed personally.
Yeah, that's right up your alley with those superhero movies.
Right.
We are discussing movies this hour with two Wisconsin film educators, Chris Yogerst and Anna Thompson-Hodgick are here. You can join in at any point, 800-642-1234. Which new movies have you seen and loved this year? Which ones were big letdowns? What are you excited to see this fall? You can join in, email ideas at WPR.org. Let's bring in Ed now, joining us from McFarland. Hi, Ed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to take it back to the first movie you talked about, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, I think is the title of it. And just wanted to point out that the actor that played Bruce Lee isn't from Sun Prairie, but currently, I believe, lives in Sun Prairie.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely while they made the movie, he was living in Sun Prairie at the time. Secondly, I wanted to ask, I saw that Bruce Lee's daughter seemed to have issues with how Bruce Lee was portrayed. I didn't understand what her issues were. If they could explain what the issue she had was and what they thought of how Bruce Lee was portrayed in the movie. Thank you.
Anna, do you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah. You know, so I'm not exactly familiar with the controversy, but I can say certainly that the depiction of Bruce Lee, he kind of comes off a little bit as a joke in the film. And so he and the character played by Brad Pitt, who plays a stuntman that works with Leonardo DiCaprio's character, you know, they kind of have this interaction and, you know, Brad Pitt gets the best of Bruce Lee, essentially, is what happens in that sequence. And he's kind of made out to be a bit of a buffoon, Bruce Lee is. So I could see certainly why the daughter would have a bit of a problem with the depiction, certainly.
Well, so. Chris, Tarantino defended his portrayal of Bruce Lee as, an arrogant actor. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I found it interesting. I mean, this is one of those situations where I can understand both sides of it where, I mean, as the daughter of a dad, you don't want to see him kind of lampooned in a major movie. And she went back to, he was mistreated in Hollywood at the time. So she didn't saw this as like a reverting back to that. But Tarantino interestingly said that, everything that he had heard, he was just basing on people that knew him that he knows in the industry. And they're like, this is how he was described to me, so this is how I portrayed him. So I can't fault him for going on what he's heard from what he thinks are reliable sources. But, at the same time, like Anna said, I mean, it's a comedic scene. I mean, he's kind of the butt of the joke in it. And it's, it is what it is.
Well, let's move on to another biopic this fall, one with Renee Zellweger playing and singing Judy Garland.
Somewhere.
So another case of Hollywood making movies about itself. But, in Judy, we get to explore a late in life female star. Anna, do you see this film potentially breaking fresh ground here?
Well, I've heard really wonderful things about Renee Zellweger's performance. And critics have been maybe a little less kind on the overall film itself. But, in terms of Zellweger's performance, it's apparently a tour de force performance. I'm not necessarily sure it's a movie that breaks new ground. I mean, we've had plenty of actors and actresses over the years really be able to sort of transform themselves into whoever they are that they're playing in terms of, thinking back to sort of, for example, Meryl Streep, right, as Julia Child. That was also, an incredible performance. I do think Zellweger's ability here to really mimic Garland's voice is quite remarkable, and there was a lot of attention as to whether or not Garland's own voice was going to be used or Zellweger was going to attempt it herself, and she does. That is actually her singing in that clip you played, which is, again, takes a lot of chutzpah on the part of Zellweger. And I think that is a testament to, again, all the amazing buzz that she's been getting as performing as Garland.
Chris, what do you think about Judy?
I also am very anxious to see it. I mean, I think Judy Garland is an interesting story. You know, like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, a story that is also both beautiful and tragic. But I'm also impressed with the singing and her way to transform into this wonderful actress and singer and mirror some of these moments. But I think it's definitely a story worth telling. I mean, like Anna said, I mean, movies about movies are nothing new. They're always fun. They're nothing new. But if anything, these kinds of movies can, just kind of like we do in our classes, try to sell a new generation, upcoming generation, on some of the high points of older Hollywood.
We're getting a guide to fall's best, biggest movies with UW Milwaukee's Chris Yogerst, and we have UW Whitewater's Anna Thompson-Hodgick. What type of films do you like to see? Do you still make an effort to attend a showing at your local theater, or do you wait to stream movies on Netflix? What big movies are you anticipating in the coming months? Join in 800-642-1234, and we'll spend some time on the Disney franchise after a news update right here on the Ideas Network.
When troubles melt like lemon drops away above the chimney tops, that's where you find.
It's set to be a busy few months with notable new movies releasing every week. We're getting a fall movie preview here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Plenty of sequels coming our way. The action franchises Rambo and Terminator both have new movies. And then Anna and Elsa are back facing danger in the Enchanted Forest. Frozen 2 comes out next month. Are you a cinephile? What types of films do you like to see? Do you still make an effort to go to a showing at your local theater? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Anna Thompson-Hodgick and Chris Yogerst teach courses on film at the UW-Whitewater and UW-Milwaukee, respectively. They stay with us through the hour. Chris, let's move on to Jojo Rabbit, which comes out this week on the 18th. Seems to involve a young boy in Nazi Germany who has Hitler as his imaginary friend.
Sheesh, that was intense.
What am I going to do?
No idea.
Got it! I will negotiate.
Burn down the house and blame Winston Churchill. We'll negotiate.
Okay, so Chris, this movie is being billed as a black comedy, but does it still take a risk, in light of Nazism?
Yeah, I think it definitely does. I mean, anytime you bring in Nazism, particularly in this kind of movie, I mean, this isn't something like, your standard World War II fare where it's going to be a heavy-hearted kind of thing. I mean, bringing this into a comedy, I mean, I'm reminded of the movie 50-50, which was a cancer comedy. And you hear that, like, what? So it's like a Hitler comedy. But it's interesting because it focuses on kids. And so you have the Hitler youth and you have these kids, Jewish and Hitler youth, and they're befriending each other. And I definitely think it takes a risk. I'm very anxious to see it. I'm hoping it's going to be the kind of movie that kind of redeems our faith in the human spirit with this really dark backdrop kind of thing. But we'll see. It's coming soon.
Okay. Anna, any thoughts here with movies about Nazism or other controversial topics? Where do you think movies risk going overboard here? Crossing a line.
Yeah. I'm reminded certainly of a movie like The Producers, right? The great Mel Brooks comedy from the late 1960s. You know, it's interesting. Mel Brooks had given an interview a few years ago now where he said that, that our culture has gotten so politically correct that he couldn't probably make half the movies that he made in the 60s and 70s. But in The Producers, there's a number titled Springtime for Hitler. And, it's obviously a very black comedic number. But that strain certainly through comedy is, alive and well. And I think it... I just have seen a preview now of Jojo Rabbit, and I'm reminded of a much more recent movie that kind of tried to take a bit of a humorous humorous sort of take on the Holocaust, and that was Life is Beautiful, which, you know, that obviously was a very different sort of movie. And again, it's just a really fine line for filmmakers to toe in terms of whether or not those movies, you know, are going to catch or just be, you know, dismissed entirely because of their comedic content.
Well, we will just have to see on that one. Let's talk about another film that seems to be weirding out audiences weeks before its release.
Midnight, not a sound from the pavement.
Cats comes out in December, featuring CGI cats with human-like faces. Now, this is, for months, we've been talking about these cats looking too human. Chris, what are you feeling about this? Are you going to see Cats?
I'll probably wait till it's on Netflix.
Okay.
To be honest. But I know what they're talking about, though. I mean, it is kind of jarring and strange. So it's one of these things. It's either going to work beautifully or it's going to fail miserably.
Anna, Chris was pretty short there on an answer. I'm just going to go to you here.
Well, I mean, I think it, yeah. I mean, obviously the music is timeless and you're going to have maybe a built-in fan base no matter what for a movie like Cats. But, you know,
it's totally built in.
Right,
on. I mean, look at Broadway here.
Right, right. Well, and again, too, I mean, I think one issue, though, is this an example of CGI sort of run amok? That's going to be a big question, right? Is it too creepy, right? And there's even a term for this. There's a term called the uncanny valley, where, you know, if you have something that doesn't look as human enough, right, it can really creep out audiences. And this is a phenomenon that really started with the movie on the Polar Express a few years ago, where you had it was a Christmas film, and, you know, Pedigree, Tom Hanks kind of voiced one of the main characters. And the characters, you know, they just, you know, it was a form of animation where they, you know, they just didn't look quite, you know, it was just not quite human enough, but too human for being kind of cute little animation. And that may be an issue that Cats runs into.
Yeah, we were talking about that some months back with Anne Hornaday from the Washington Post. And, you know, even the trailer has gotten a lot of play just because of that creepiness effect. Chris, we're going to pull you along here.
it's funny, you... one thing I just thought of, this actually kind of parallels a similar discussion with The Irishman, Martin Scorsese's new gangster film. And they, same thing, they use de-aging technology on these actors, Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and these guys, Al Pacino, that are in their 60s and 70s or maybe even older. I'm not even sure, to make them look decades younger. And if you watch the trailers, I mean, it is jarring. And I'm very, I don't know how that's going to play for a 4-hour movie either.
We are discussing movies with two Wisconsin film educators. Chris Yogerst and Anna Thompson-Hodgick are here. You can join the conversation any point, 800-642-1234. Which new movies have you seen this year? What did you love or hate about them? Which movies do you want to see this fall? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. All right. It is time. It is time to talk the Disney franchise and the F word, Frozen.
Has Elsa seemed weird to you?
She seems like Elsa.
There's this voice.
Voice? What does that mean?
Oh, my goodness. Frozen 2 coming out next month. And I have to say, the merchandise is everywhere. I, you know, walking into the big box store, starting with a T last night, and it's like you walk into Frozen 2. So, Anna, what gives here? What are you thinking about, you know, Disney's next, Frozen 2?
Well, again, you know, if it's not broke, don't fix it. I mean, that's Disney's kind of mantra in a lot of ways, you know, and you know, they, I mean, it's not surprising, obviously, right? And, you know, Disney is kind of in this mode right now, too, where they're not only are they, you know, putting out this Frozen sequel, but they are remaking all of their, you know, their animated classics with live action, right? So you had The Lion King this summer. You have Mulan coming out with an actress playing Mulan. And it just kind of goes on and on and on, right? Does Disney maybe need some fresh ideas? Yeah, maybe. You know, I mean, I think that but it is hard to resist just the, you know, kind of guaranteed box office success of franchises like this where, you know, families know what to expect. If you have Anna and Elsa fans in your household, it's going to be hard, very hard to resist.
Well, Chris, you know, Frozen did pave the way for musical movies like Moana and Coco. What do you see there?
Yeah, you definitely, I mean, I agree with Anna. I mean, Disney could probably use some new ideas. But also, I mean, if you know, it's a little bit different. I mean, I'd love to criticize originality, but if you've got stuff that kids are interested in and they're digging it and they're enjoying it, and like you said, you can't walk into these big box stores without seeing it. You can't. I mean, last year, my wife and I were in, actually 2 years ago, in Anaheim, and you're walking around Disney, you see these kids all dressed up. It's like, you know what, whatever they're doing, if the kids love it, great. Like Anna alluded to, it's always good business, right? They own the rights to these things and they've got a built-in audience. So that's one of the reasons why we keep seeing these things.
Chris, do you see a lot of fresh stories coming out from animation films this year?
Off the top of my head, I'm not really sure.
Yeah. Anna, you know, what does the market look like for animated films? You know, are we going into the season looking like animated films are going to really hit?
You know, I haven't heard a lot about kind of the animated genre, but I do know, you know, Into the Spider-Verse was one of the great, you know, the great successes of this last summer. And so certainly that film's success, I think we may see, more unique takes maybe on sort of classic stories as a result of Into the Spider-Verse's tremendous success. My husband is quite the kind of movie fan, but also he's very discerning. And he said that that's the best movie he's seen in the last probably 3 years, and took our daughter to that. And so that was a movie, too, that I think was a very intergenerational hit. So, again, it's not just, you know, taking the kids to Frozen 2 because you feel like you have to. Into the Spider-Verse was something that was, again, a successful movie, again, across generations. And so mm-hmm. when a movie like that has such hits so well, certainly you're going to see imitators, I think, and particularly that particular director and writer attached to that film certainly will probably has inked a multi-picture deal, I'm sure.
UW film mm-hmm. educators Anna Thompson-Hodgick and Chris Yogerst are talking film with us and looking at movies hitting theaters this fall, including Frozen 2 from Disney. You have a line, 800-642-1234. And I promise parents, we won't play Let It Go after this one time, but earworms are hard to help. Back in a moment. More conversation here on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the fall box office on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. There is no shortage of films to see this fall. The anticipated Scorsese film The Irishman is the saga of a hitman. Brad Pitt and Natalie Portman take us to space in Ad Astra and Lucy in the Sky. And Tom Hanks is Mr. Rogers, by the way, in A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood out next month. So what movies are you making time for this fall, and what will you see in the Thanksgiving season when family's around? We're at 800-642-1234. UW-Milwaukee's Chris Yogerst and UW-Whitewater's Anna Thompson-Hodgick stay with us. So fans are getting a lot of sequels this fall to big Hollywood hits. There's Star Wars, there's Terminator, Zombieland, Jumanji, even a sequel to The Shining from 1980.
Not many ride the bus this far north. You're running away from something?
I'm running away from myself, I guess.
Okay, so that's the trailer from Dr. Sleep. Comes out November 8th. Ewan McGregor plays an adult Danny Torrance, the young boy in The Shining who has special abilities. Anna, what are you seeing out of these sequels?
Well, I think, again, you know, it's kind of like our previous conversation related to Frozen 2. Hollywood, you know, works on precedent. And they, you know, again, want to, it takes a lot of money, a lot of resources, right, to produce a film, to have a big budget release. And you don't necessarily want to rock the boat. Now, of course, you know, certainly there's always room for those original screenplays and original stories. But, you know, Dr. Sleep, I find it to be a particularly kind of interesting sequel in that, you know, it takes a story that is obviously well known to, you know, the bulk of the American public. And at the same time, you know, Stephen King is very much around, still around. You know, he is someone that is always, you know, producing new books every year. I believe
really prolific, yeah,
very prolific. And I think he had some involvement. I'm not exactly sure of the history, but I think he has some involvement in helping to bring this film to fruition. And you know, anchored by a pretty good actor there, Ewan McGregor, it has potential.
Has some legs there, Chris. You know, movie theaters, they seem to be getting a break from the blockbuster superhero movies and the sequels for a while. What are you seeing here?
I find this an interesting sequel in the sense that this isn't, you know, like 2 years after The Shining came out. You know, that was what, in 1980. So, like Anna said, it's a well-established narrative. And this is, I think, kind of a cool way to get people back into that narrative, to revisit it. It's actually made me interested in revisiting The Shining myself, a film that I've always loved. But there's a lot of talk of sequels as being kind of derivative, but they can, I understand the criticism, but I also kind of love them. I mean, if there's a franchise you love, it's just more time with these characters, more time with that narrative. Sometimes, I mean, for me, it doesn't matter if it's as good as the original or not. I go back to the original. I mean, it's Halloween month, so the original Universal horror movies, where they made tons of sequels of Frankenstein and Dracula and Mummy, and they're all fun. So the bottom line for me is that if you like it, just enjoy it.
Yeah, well, you love those superhero origin stories. That goes, like, right to your heart.
Yep. Yeah, definitely.
Let's go to Tom now, joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Tom.
Hi. So my comment is, the Bible says that nothing's new under the sun. You know, and if you go back to Shakespeare, there's only 8 or 9 original stories, like man versus man versus God, you know, man versus self or whatever. So basically, everything I feel is pretty much, you know, a remake or an adaptation of one of those forms of storylines. And nothing's ever as good as the book. I'll just say that.
Ah. Anna, your thoughts there?
Yeah, I mean, that, of course, that is a criticism that you can level at any sort of film version of the book, right? Mm-hmm. With a few exceptions over the years, you know, too. I mean, I don't know, The Godfather, you know, celebrated its anniversary this last year, and I think that's one exception. Maybe The Godfather, the film, that trilogy was superior to the source material. Those are sort of few and far between, those sorts of examples of where the movie is actually better than the book.
Chris, what do you make of that? That there are some tired storylines coming out of Hollywood.
There certainly are. I mean, one thing I just wanted to add about the book or movie being better, I mean, this is something that comes up in my classes, and usually where I fall is that maybe we should stop comparing them, because they're different mediums. You know, a lot of times people like books that are a little bit more imaginative. Some people that like a little bit more visuals will get more out of movies. And I think a lot of times the book and the movie can be great supplements to one another. But yeah, so there's that.
Well, and I want to make sure that we are able to get this in because public television is near and dear to our hearts here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take a listen to Mr. Rogers here.
Hey, I'm looking for Fred Rogers in here.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
Okay, so Tom Hanks playing Fred Rogers in the film It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, out the week before Thanksgiving. Anna, this movie seems to have Oscar potential for Tom Hanks, but, you know, perhaps we're biased here. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I've heard very good things about Tom Hanks' performance here as Fred Rogers. And, you know, he has two Oscars already, so it's not necessarily a sure bet. But as somebody, one of the authors I had read recently, journalists that I read recently, you know, it's been a while. Castaway was the last movie that he won an Academy Award for, and it's been a few years now. So, and you know, again, I think Fred Rogers, just the person, right, has been, you know, kind of back in our sort of popular culture a lot in the last few years. And, you know, our nation is a fairly polarized country right now. And I think turning back to this era of when that program was on, when Fred Rogers was still alive, is comforting for a good segment of our audience, of the American public. And, you know, that documentary about Fred Rogers was very very popular as well and was well received. And I think that this film, following on the heels of that documentary, is going to also be very much embraced.
Well, Chris Yogerst, I have one more for you. In late November, Netflix plans to release The Irishman from director Martin Scorsese.
Things have gotten out of hand with our friend.
You gotta sit down. Everybody says so.
No, I'm not sitting down. I can't do it.
It's what it is.
What it is.
I know things they don't know I know.
Oh, so familiar voices are Joe Pesci, Robert De Niro, and Al Pacino. What do you make of The Irishman?
I think it's going to be, I'm really excited about it. I know Martin Scorsese is long. I mean, he's a varied filmmaker, but he's probably most known for his ability to capture crime and gangster narratives in unique and engaging ways. And this is the perfect movie for him. They couldn't have cast it better. They couldn't have found a better director. And it's based on the disappearance of Jimmy Hoffa, which is something that, you know, it still captured the imaginations of true crime aficionados, because to this day, we still don't know exactly what happened.
Oh, yeah. And true crime is just such a popular, popular genre right now. It just seems like the right place at the right time.
Definitely. Definitely. And like I said, that you couldn't find a better director. I mean, you know, coming off of The Departed and, of course, classics like Casino and Goodfellas. He's and the 4-hour runtime. For people really interested in it.
Well, Anna, we only have a few seconds here, but I know you teach gender and film. Any thoughts on that and women in Hollywood?
Yeah, well, again, I think, you know, things are in this, again, post-Weinstein, post-Me Too era. You know, Hollywood is definitely, it is a more diverse place. Is there room for improvement? Yes, there still is, of course. We still need more female studio executives, for example, more female producers, certainly. We have definitely seen progress just in the last 2 years, for sure.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been just a real pleasure.
Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Chris Yogerst and Anna Thompson-Hodgick, they teach courses on film at the UW-Milwaukee and the UW-Whitewater, respectively. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.